Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Well, socialism on the rise on Wall Street. It's amazing. Welcome. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Ronnie Reagan.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And now that's Mr. Paulson's mantra. We will be getting to that, to what's really going on, to the bailout of the derivative industry, among other things, as we continue on through the program, particularly in our second and third hour. Ronnie Deutsch is going to drop by in our second hour. That should be entertaining. And I want to just lay out this whole thing, how it came about, what's going on and where it's going. But first, John Fund is with us, and John is the writes the weekly On the Trail column for OpinionJournal.com. He's the author of a new book, Stealing Elections: How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy. Writes over at OpinionJournal.com. John, welcome to the show.
Pleasure, Tom. And by the way, I endorse all of your skepticism about the federal bailout of the derivative industry.
I suspected you probably would. But let's talk about stolen elections here. I find this fascinating that you would write a book arguing that the problem we have in the United States is people, like conservatives down in Florida who register themselves at their real estate agent rather than their home, in other words, voter fraud, as opposed to, a few felons here and there who are voting and shouldn't be, as opposed to the millions of caging pieces that have been going out, the fact that the Republican Party has been operating under quarters since the 80s, banning them from caging, and yet they're still doing it. What's the disconnect here, John? What am I missing?
Well, I think that there are two civil rights at stake here, and one is one that we had a great civil rights battle in the 1960s over to make sure people weren't blocked from voting from poll taxes or intimidation or literacy tests. We have to preserve those gains. And then there's another civil right, which Larry Sabato, the noted political scientist from the University of Virginia, and many other people are also concerned about, and that is the civil right of people not to have their vote canceled out by people who shouldn't be voting, people who are voting twice, or people who don't even exist. And it doesn't just happen in Chicago. I have examples in front of me of voter registrar fraud cases the last few weeks, and everywhere from Louisiana to Wisconsin to Ohio to Michigan to Seattle.
That adds up to how many instances?
Well, let's see. We've had, in the last year, we've had people convicted and also pled guilty to voter fraud in St. Louis, in Kansas City, in Seattle. I can give you half another dozen other cities if you want me to discuss.
Sure, no, I'm just wondering what the total number of people is.
Well, the bottom line is, as Larry Sabato says, voter fraud is a felony. The fact that you do not always detect it and are able to prosecute it does not mean that there isn't a lot, like an iceberg.
Right, but I'm wondering how many people have been successfully prosecuted for voter fraud.
Well, the federal government, during a three-year period, had 70 successful convictions, but most state prosecutions are at the local level.
So we have 70
no,
people.
No, federal prosecutions that violated.
How many local prosecutions have there been?
They've been hundreds.
Okay, so we've got a few hundred people.
And no, hundreds of prosecutions, not hundreds of fraudulent votes.
Hundreds of prosecutions, okay.
Yes.
Hundreds of prosecutions. And yet thousands of people are being purged from the voter rolls. I mean, you had down in Florida, you had this company that was hired by Catherine Harris, as you're well aware, to purge people who had names similar to felons in Texas from the voter rolls in Florida.
Well,
that one incident alone is greater than all the numbers that you just cited.
Okay. Tom, the Palm Beach Post and the Miami Herald are known as liberal newspapers. They both endorsed Al Gore in 2000. They editorialized against, and I certainly did, against the people who were unfairly knocked off the rolls as felons when they weren't. It turned out that several hundred people were barred from voting because of that. That was flat out wrong. What you perhaps not have heard is what the Palm Beach Post and the Miami Herald did find, which is that 3,800 people who were ineligible felons ended up voting in that election. Don't you think that was wrong as well?
I think the whole problem here, there's even a bigger problem.
Well, don't you think that was wrong as well? Because
sure,
the difference in
sure,
voting.
Absolutely.
But there were only 537 votes separating Gore and Bush. Both cases.
Actually,
the
ACLU is alleging that it's tens of thousands of people who were knocked off.
No.
Thousands to tens of thousands of people.
I'm talking about
the
people who ended up not voting.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. People who tried to vote, who couldn't vote because their names were stripped off the list. But isn't there even a larger issue than either of these two issues, which is that our vote has been privatized? Our votes are now in the hands of private corporations. If the beating heart of democracy is our vote, and if the whole point of a republic is to have a government of, by, and for the people that is answerable exclusively to the people, then why do we have private corporations owning our vote? Why do we have private corporations maintaining our voting rolls, as Catherine Harris did down in Florida?
Well, first of all, that
is this not a crime against democracy?
I think we can find some area of common agreement, but let me first say that that incident in Florida has certainly scared off, as it should have, a lot of voter registration officials from ever having done that again. There is very little of that being done. What I think we can find common ground on is this. We spend too little maintaining our elections and making sure they run freely and fairly. We hire a lot of private companies on low-bid contracts. They give us electronic voting machines that cost about one-tenth of the ATM machine that we trust our money to, and we often get about one-tenth the quality. I agree with you, there are software problems. I don't buy the conspiracy theories of Manchurian hackers behind the scenes wholesale changing election results, and Joe Andrew, the former Democratic National Committee chairman under Bill Clinton, endorses my view. But we need to spend more money on these machines. We need to certainly monitor the contracts better. And frankly, I think it is a scandal because some of these companies do it on the cheap, and some of these companies are disreputable.
There should be no companies at all.
So the government should build the electronic voting machines we use?
Frankly, no.
How is it done if you don't use a private company, if the government doesn't build the machines?
The government owns – well, first of all –
How do you do it if the government doesn't build the machines without using a private company, Tom? How? Tell me. How?
The same way we did when it was pull lever machines.
Those were built by private companies.
The government buys the machines from the private companies. Right, and government agencies bought them.
Then
and
we
were
agree.
Completely transparent. You could flip up the back panel and you could look. No, right now the software that runs these programs is owned by private corporations and licensed to the government. And that's wrong. And in fact, they're saying that trade secrets prevent them from making that software open and transparent. But frankly, I don't even think we should have voting machines. You know, in Germany, they use paper. In France, they use paper. In England, they use paper. In Canada, they tried our voting machines 6 years ago and said, this is nuts, and sent
Tom,
them back. They use
Tom,
paper.
Tom, I can understand a lot of legitimate concerns about the new technology, but electronic voting machines properly installed, properly maintained, and the NAACP originally supported this concept because they felt that elderly, handicapped, and other people were much better served by electronic voting machines. If you want to go to
paper,
that's
how it was sold, but they no longer support it.
Well, under political pressure. But I will tell you, the original motivation was electronic voting machines help the poor, the handicapped, and the elderly. Now, I think, properly maintained, they can. If you want to go to a system that is the most prone to fraud and manipulation, it's paper ballots. And that is why political machines in Chicago and Philadelphia and various other places would love to go back to paper ballots, because that's the easiest way to steal an election, regardless of party.
You don't... Okay.
If you don't think elections have been stolen
I'll grant you that. You know, we've been stuffing ballots since the beginning, John.
That's why we originally call it stuffing ballot boxes.
But I would like to be able to have a piece of paper there where you can have
people who are
looking at these things.
You're talking about a paper trail. I agree with you. We need a system,
if you're going to have electronic voting machines, have them be nothing more than fancy printers.
Well, yes, but you wouldn't want the person to be able to take the written record of their vote away from the polling place, because they could easily sell that to someone as proof that they had voted a certain way.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm simply saying have it be nothing more than a fancy printer, so that there is a printout. So after you push the buttons, you get a printout. You can take a look at it and say, yep, that's how I voted, and that is what gets counted.
Fine.
That's a ballot.
On that we have agreement.
It's a ballot printer, but the machine is not keeping track of the count.
Well, okay, maybe we can develop a machine that we're both happy with, but I agree with you that it's not available now.
I mean, here in Oregon, for example, we have 100% paper. 100% paper. We vote by mail. It's 100% paper. In Vermont, I believe it's 100% paper.
And the vote by mail system has certainly had its problems, as we witnessed across the river in Washington State in 2004 in their governor's race, and that was an unhappy situation.
Yeah.
You agree, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly was an unhappy situation. Dino Rossi was very, you know, was yelling voter fraud.
Well, let's just say
he was claiming that there was fraud in electronic machines.
Tom, they found new votes 16 times during that count. That was a problem.
Okay. John Fund, opinionjournal.com. His book, Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy. John, good talking with you.
Pleasure, Tom.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Some good news in here, I suppose, 21 minutes past the hour. Jennifer Brunner, who is the Ohio Secretary of State, the Democrat elected in 2006, has said that this year, unlike in 2004, the voting machines will not have sleepovers. In other words, they won't go home with the election workers. CNN is reporting a new Government Accountability Office, GAO office report on voting system testing finds that the Electronic Assistance Commission has failed to notify election officials across the country about electronic voting machine failures. The article also said a new study by Common Cause and the Century Foundation finds that 10 very vital swing states have significant voting systems that have not been addressed since the last election. I'm quoting this CNN report here. These 10 states, according to Common Cause, are Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, Missouri, New Mexico, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. What a coincidence. What a coincidence. Our corporate voting machines, our corporate... Oh, man. But what we really have to be worried about is a felon voting. 866-303-2270. And then, as I said, I want to lay out for you what's going on with this economy in a way, hopefully, that's going to make some sense. It's going to take a few minutes. And the election fraud, frankly, and it's not voter fraud in my mind that is the issue we need to be concerned about. It's election fraud. It is the wholesale theft of our elections. It's caging that Karl Rove has been engaging in for the better part of 8 years or longer. It is voter suppression. It is all these letters that are going out from the McCain campaign to people all across the country. With, you know, want to vote by mail, want to do an absentee ballot, mail this in to the wrong address. There's really nasty stuff going on. Election fraud is huge. If they stole 2 million votes in the 2000 election, between 2 and 4 million, which I think is probably a reasonable guess. If they stole between 4 and 6 million in the 2004 election, which is pretty reasonable guess. Mark Crispin Miller, of course, documents all this brilliantly in his book, Fooled Again. They're probably going to steal 6, 8, 10 million this time, which means we have to turn out 15 million voters. I mean, it's just that's the bottom line. Melinda in Pennsauken, New Jersey. Hey, Melinda.
I just wanted to ask you about the McCain mailings. And then in New Jersey, where I live, 300,000 people were bounced off the rolls and told they weren't registered when they were. Mostly, these things are happening to Democrats or Obama supporters.
Right, and largely in Democratic districts. We're seeing this all across the country, and you need to be able to, you need to check, and you can check with your local Secretary of State's office, with your Secretary of State's office, or your election, your county commissioner, I guess, is the place where you would, you know, make sure that you're registered to vote, and if you haven't registered to vote, get out there and register to vote. Thank you very much. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. By the way, it is hundreds of thousands of voters. Like in Colorado, they removed 20% of the voters from the list recently. Now, most of those may have been legitimate, but there are still many that will be questionable whether
sure.
there should have been purge or not. So, again, it's hundreds of thousands. But a thing that I'd like everybody to think about here is, first of all, even if we have paper ballots, most are counted by machines right now, and machines are prone to error. And anything about electronic voting and error is generally invisible. So we can't detect it for the most part. There's no way of auditing it. There's no way of seeing it. And I ask everybody to consider one thing, that Diebold Election Systems, they bought a company called Global Election Systems, and the main programmer, chief programmer, was convicted, not accused, but convicted of 23 felony counts of planning backdoors in software he created for ATMs. And so a lot of people are voting on that software.
Yeah.
That was created by this person.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's not how the ballot is cast. It's not that it's paper. It's how it's counted is the important point.
Yeah, as Joe Stalin said.
And consider how many people it take to do the fraud with paper ballots. You do have to have a big conspiracy to have a lot of people throw, you know, thousands of votes for an election with, you know, paper ballots and ballot boxes.
Right.
Absolutely. But one person could throw a million votes with electronic voting machines.
By the way, over at the Obama campaign, BarackObama.com, there is a section on that on his website where the Democratic Party and the campaign are looking for people to act as poll workers, and they're also looking for lawyers who want to volunteer to participate on Election Day.
The best thing you can do right now to help county clerks, they really, really, really need your help, is volunteer for the entire day on Election Day. They need poll workers now, and they have asked us over and over again, you know, to please help get
It's not enough to vote. Take the day off work and be and offer to be a volunteer.
There are all different positions you can do, from just helping people in line to manning the poll books to working with things in the evening. Taking down the machines. There are plenty of positions they really need help.
And the Republicans are going to have people at these polls the Republicans are going to be having people at these polls who are going to be challenging voters.
Yeah.
It's also possible if you don't want to, or if you can't get the whole day, if you don't want to, you know, volunteer with the county or as an election helper, you can also volunteer with the Democratic Party as an election observer.
There are all sorts of election observer positions with different election protection organizations.
Yes.
First, I'd say volunteer with your government. Secondly, volunteer with one of the election protection organizations.
Yeah, very well said. Very well said, Jeff. Thank you very much for the call. And we'll continue. Actually, I want to drill down into some of this economic stuff, so let's get into that at the bottom of the hour. And then we'll be just continue to pick up your calls. Ronnie Deutsch will be with us at the top of the next hour. And that should be interesting. We'll see if she's decided to renounce her right-wing free market ideology. Stick around. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. In 1917, he was an itinerant house painter in Florida. World War I was just ending. The financial system was in shambles in Europe. His name, Charles A. Ponzi. He moved to Boston in 1919, rented an office in Pie Alley, where he opened a company called the Securities Exchange Company, SEC. His company, he said, was incorporated to buy up international postal reply coupons, basically the right to send a letter, sort of like stamps, from Germany and France, where the currencies were collapsed, and redeem them in the U.S. for U.S. currency. Now, this was actually impossible to do, but it made enough sense to people that 40,000 Bostonians handed over their life savings to Ponzi within the first few weeks. He was promising a 50% return within 45 days. And in fact, the first couple thousand people did get a 50% return. They put in $10,000, they'd get back $15,000 45 days later. They'd tell their friends would rush in. In fact, it was amazing. I mean, he had several dozen clerks at Pi Alley who were working long into the night stacking, counting stacks of cash. He accumulated over $15 million in less than 6 months. And that's back when $15 million was a lot of money. It would be at least a couple hundred million dollars in today's money, probably a whole lot more than that. A newspaper reporter described him, Charles Ponzi, as the greatest Italian American who ever lived. He said, "You're wrong. There's Columbus, who discovered America, and Marconi, who discovered radio." Then, you know, word spread as a result of an article, actually, in one of the Boston newspapers, that he was paying off current money with old money, that it was just a Ponzi scheme. Thus we have the term. Well, let me tell you, what is happening right now is a Ponzi scheme unraveling, which is not all that different from the ones that Charles Ponzi invented, in as much as it is people trading things that represent no value. They start out with things that have value. Originally, the whole derivatives market was to say, okay, if I've got some wheat, if I'm a farmer and I have wheat, and you're a bread maker and you want to buy wheat from me, and it's the beginning of the growing season, and I contract with you to say, okay, I'll sell you all my wheat at the end of the year for $5 a bushel, and you say, okay, great, I'll buy it for $5 a bushel, and we both write a contract for that. And then I may also want to negotiate a contract with another farmer in case my crop fails that says I'll buy wheat from them at, ideally less than $5 a bushel, because I know I have to deliver it at least at $5, and that's kind of hedging your bets. But we're talking about real wheat here. And if you're the baker, you may also say, maybe somebody will sell me wheat at a different price, or I higher or lower, depending on how the market goes. So the origination of derivatives was basically betting against the failure of the delivery of a commodity. Now we have derivatives. You can buy derivatives. You can buy bets on the weather. You can buy bets on whether the stock market will go up or down without any stocks being purchased. It's simply a bet. And this has grown. This system, what is being bailed out right now, is not the banking system. What is being bailed out is the derivatives system. These, by and large, in their current incarnation, these did not even exist before Reagan came into office. These things are the result in large part of a series of deregulations, first of savings and loans, then of banks, then of investment companies, and of the structure of investment companies that has led to basically this shadow system. In fact, Nouriel Roubini in today's Financial Times, excellent op-ed piece, the writer, chairman of Roubini Global Economics, is a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business, New York University. Roubini writes, "Last week saw the demise of the shadow banking system that has been created over the past 20 years. Because of a greater regulation of banks, most financial intermediation in the past two decades has grown within the shadow system." Okay, because banks are highly regulated, all this stuff has been happening in the shadow system. And wait until it's going to cross your eyes when I tell you how much money is involved in this thing. These members include broker-dealers, hedge funds, private equity groups, structured investment vehicles and conduits, money market funds, and non-bank mortgage lenders. Many of whom, by the way, let me add, did not even exist when Ronald Reagan came into office. Unlike banks, Roubini says, which are sheltered from the risk of a run in the bank with deposit insurance and central banks lender of last resort, most members of the shadow system did not have access to those firewalls that prevent runs on the bank. Roubini is suggesting that we are just looking at the beginning of this. Hedge funds were put together, hedging against changes in the market. This is all about derivatives. Hedge funds were put together for very wealthy people to get in and play these games. I remember back six, eight, 10 years ago, a friend of mine was talking about all the money he was making in a hedge fund, fairly wealthy friend. And so, you know, I called up a broker and I said, you know, how do I get into a hedge fund? This sounds like a good idea. And he says, you have to have a liquid net asset value of $1 million. In other words, you have to be able to write a check for $1 million. And you have to have a minimum investment of $250,000. Otherwise, they won't even talk to you. Hedge fund won't even let you in. And what the hedge funds do is you give them the $250,000 or, you know, hundreds of millions, whatever it is. They lock it up typically for 6 months. And then only four times a year can you take your money out. So we haven't seen the hedge funds crash because there can't, because the way they've structured them, there can't be a run on them yet. But wait a few months. In fact, this is what Rubini says in today's Financial Times. He talks about the various stages that we've gone through. The first step was the asset bubble bursting. The second one was the run on the big U.S. broker dealers. The third stage was the collapse of other leveraged institutions, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, AIG. The fourth stage was the panic in the money markets. The next stage, Rubini writes in today's Financial Times, the next stage will be a run on thousands of highly leveraged hedge funds. After a brief lockup period, investors in such funds can redeem their investments on a quarterly basis. Thus, a bank-like run on hedge funds is highly possible. Now, how much money are we talking about here? This is where it gets truly mind-boggling. Because the derivatives market is gambling, because it doesn't require any underlying assets in many cases. And in fact, you've got people who are trading on whether or not derivatives will go up or down. So you start out with the wheat. The wheat, then somebody bets on whether or not the price of wheat will go up or down. And that becomes a buy or a sell. That becomes something that can be sold. And then somebody bets on whether the bet on whether the wheat will go up or down will go up or down. And then somebody bets on the bet of whether the wheat. And see, this is where it becomes a Ponzi scheme. And because you can bet on things that have absolutely no value at all, they simply 5, 10, 15 things down the chain represent some original value. And Paulson's running around saying it's all real estate. And yeah, that's where a lot of it started. Because you can do that, the total gross domestic product of all the countries in the world right now is $60 trillion. Right, the world. In other words, the world is producing $60 trillion worth of wealth every year. Every country in the world combined. The derivatives market, the total number, and this is according to the Bank of International Settlements, the total number of derivative trades this year exceeds $1,000 trillion. That's a quadrillion dollars. There's only $60 trillion, 60,000 billion, only $60 trillion of total GDP, total economic activity in the world. And yet $1,000 trillion is being traded in derivatives. And what's happening, Warren Buffett, 2 years ago, said derivatives are weapons of financial mass destruction. That's a verbatim quote. So what's happening right now is that they are putting their fingers in the dike. They're doing nothing to stop trading in derivatives. They're doing nothing to stop the Ponzi scheme. They're doing nothing to all they're doing is just throwing some money into this thing to try to get them to November 4th. That's what this is all about, is to not have this thing collapse so that John McCain loses the election. That's what's going on. Pure and simple. Because if they were serious about this, if they were serious about fixing this situation, they would say, hey, you know, let's restructure these. Let's just unroll. Let's put the onion back together. Let's go back to the way things were before Reagan came into office. By the way, did you notice that the Fed bought AIG, 80% stake in the American Insurance Group? The Fed is a private banking corporation. They bought it with money from the U.S. Treasury. How did that happen? The Federal Reserve, it's not part of the U.S. government. And it just bought the largest insurance company? And it used your and my money to do it? What we are witnessing is the rich and the hyper-rich making off with pretty much everything we've got. And if they make off with our democracy at the same time, we got nothing. I am frankly not so concerned about a Mussolini-style fascism coming to the United States. as I am a brand new kind of fascism where a single institution within the government, the executive branch, ends up owning the private economy.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
9.5 minutes before the hour.
I find it very, very
time for one of our conservative alerts for the day. As Senator John McCain has had at least 133 lobbyists running his campaign and raising money for him. You can check it out at McCainSource.com. And given that there's fewer than 50 days to go to the election, I'm just going to every day name three of them. Here's a couple. We'll do them alphabetically. Robert Aiken. He works for Pinnacle West Financial Corporation. He's a fundraiser for McCain. And Grant Aldonis, Split Rock International, an economic advisor. His clients include Corning and Anderson, Fillmore Anderson. He works for DC Navigators. His clients include Aetna, American Council. These are by clients, the people for whom they lobby. Include Aetna, the American Council of Life Insurers, AT&T, BellSouth, Hartford Life, PGE and PG&E Corp, and Visa. Okay, so that first three. And here's one more. This from the New York Times. Senator John McCain's campaign manager was paid more than $30,000 a month for 5 years. $30,000 a month for 5 years as president of an advocacy group set up by the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to defend them against stricter regulations, current and former officials say. Now, this is while the McCain campaign is running commercials trying to say that Obama is somehow tied into the Fannie thing with Franklin Raines, which is an assertion that is wrong. Rick Davis, Mr. McCain's campaign manager and longtime advisor, helped Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac beat back regulatory challenges when he served as president of their advocacy group, the Home Ownership Alliance, formed in the summer of 2000. Yeah. So, our quote for the day. And I know there's a lot of you calling want to get in on this. There's just a little more information I want to share with you, and we'll talk with Ronnie Deutsch at the top of the hour, and then we'll take calls for the rest of the day. But our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, it's like nothing comes around but what comes around. 1802, he's president of the United States, third president of the United States. He writes a letter to Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin in 1802. He says, and I quote, "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs." Well, we've got an administration right now that wants to give it back to the banks. Keep in mind, there have been basically five regimes that have held power in the United States since the Civil War. Charles Durber wrote a brilliant book about this called Hidden Power. It's one of my BuzzFlash books of the month. You can probably, if you go over to BuzzFlash and dig through the archives, you can find the review of it. And you may even be able to still buy it there at BuzzFlash.com. The first one is the first corporate regime. This is from 1865 to 1901. It was called the Gilded Age. It was a corporate regime. Okay, then we flip to a progressive era. From 1901 to 1921, Teddy Roosevelt busting the trusts. Then we flip back to a corporate regime, 1921 to 1933. It was called the Roaring Twenties. Then we flip back to another progressive regime, the New Deal, 1933 to 1980. Then we flip to another corporate regime, the Reagan Revolution. This is the third corporate regime since the Civil War, 1980 until now. Now, I would argue that actually that should have ended in 2000, but that election was stolen. There was a coup d'etat. So Durber, in his book, he suggests that there could be a new form of fascism. He says this chapter looks at the dangers of an unprecedented tip toward a new regime that I call fascism light. It's not the kind of fascism that you see, that you saw. He says it's foreshadowed by the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security restrictions and civil liberties, the Pentagon suspension of the Geneva Accords, constitutional safeguards against arbitrary detention and abuse of terrorism suspects. He says, but it would preserve a government-corporate partnership. But in contrast to the current regime, it would clearly subordinate corporations to the state. Now, in traditional fascism, it was kind of the other way around. And keep in mind, this book was written in 2006, 2 years ago, or it was published 2 years ago. It would eliminate unions, formally subjugate the press to government censorship, increase the tie between religion and the state, and subject dissenters and tens of millions of ordinary citizens to the unconstitutional treatment and daily abuse now received by terrorist detainees. It'd be radically different from the classical forms that we saw in Nazi Germany and Italy. It'll remain a different breed. And what might cause this, Charles Durber in 2006 predicted? An economic meltdown. And what do we have here now? We have the executive branch of government. You read this legislation. Look at what George Bush is proposing right now. The executive branch of government, one of three branches. Remember, there's the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. One branch of government having the authority to spend $700-800 billion of our money to buy things up and then sell them and then buy more things. At the end of the day, Paulson or whoever replaces him could spend trillions of dollars, thousands of billions of dollars by buying things and then selling them and then buying other things and then selling them. And it's just recycling them, but recycling them to the benefit of all these companies. And particularly if what happens is that we end up with the stock of many of these companies, we could see essentially a nationalization of the corporate structure in America. And this is frankly where I'm surprised that conservatives aren't freaking out, because the nationalization of corporate stock is what the Bolsheviks did in Russia. We're talking about basically a takeover of the private sector by the government with no controls. The legislation explicitly says that there will be no oversight by the judiciary. Paulson cannot be prosecuted for anything he does. There's no oversight. They can't stop him. And there's no oversight by the legislative. They're providing no guidelines. They're simply saying, it's your money. This is the guy who is beholden to the president taking over the economy. Now, I understand the need to bail out. Bail out's the wrong phrase. I understand the need to do something about all these home loans going south. But this is trickle-down economics on steroids. This is the opposite of what we should be doing. What we should be doing is helping homeowners. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ronnie Deutsch on the line with us, the tax lady, tax attorney
and
expert.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning, Ronnie. Let me just give this plug here. Ronnie Deutsch, R-O-N-I, Deutsch, D-E-U-T-C-H .com is your website. And, in fact, there's even a 1-888 tax lady if they're interested in the services of a tax lady. So, Ronnie, are you ready now to per our last conversation some months ago, to admit the absolute and utter failure of trickle-down Reaganomics and this whole conservative agenda of the so-called free market?
Tom, I am so fired up today. Let me tell you what I'm willing to admit here, Tom. I'm willing to admit that we are in deep trouble. I'm willing to admit that the government, in my opinion, Tom, is making a horrible mistake to correct, of course, the lack of regulation and the lack of everything, Tom, they should have had.
But wait a minute. You were opposed to regulation.
Tom, I want someone to step in right now and regulate our banking industry.
I agree.
I want someone, Tom, to step in and draft rules and laws that make sense, Tom. Because
you know, all we have to do is just put back into place the rules that got rolled back by Phil Gramm in 1999. And by the way, with the enthusiastic participation of Bill Clinton and Larry Summers and you know, a few others who are still out there lurking around, Democrats as well. And but, you know, it was principally Phil Gramm, the Gramm-Bliley-Leach Act, or Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, in 99. The deregulation in 82, 83 by Reagan of the SNLs, which led directly to the SNL crash, and we had to bail them out. Then they deregulated the banks. Then they deregulated commodities trading, you know, the Enron loop, all of these things. Let's just go back to the rules we used to have that Franklin Roosevelt put into place, because he figured out that he basically figured out how to save capitalism from itself.
And again, Tom, you're bringing up those great points. I'm talking simple math. 2 + 2 today does not equal 4, and you and I know why it doesn't equal 4. And I want to step back and say to you, here's my question of the day, Tom. We're bailing out all these people. How is it going to really help the people?
It's not. It's not. What they're doing is they're trying to prevent John McCain from losing by a massive landslide. They are throwing enough money into this thing to stick enough bubble gum in the cracks in the dam here to keep it from leaking really, really badly until after November 4th, and nothing more, because there is nothing structural in this at all, and therefore, in my opinion, it is this. I think Karl Rove came up with this suggestion, because this is purely political. This has nothing to do with financial markets.
Yeah, and again, Tom, when they stand up and say that banks are now going to have more money to loan to us, I just want to know, Tom, are they going to put signs up that honestly say, come get it while you're hot? They're going to start giving me money when my balance sheet doesn't look good. They're going to start loaning money in California to people that don't have a job. 7.7% here, Tom. I just want to know, how in the world did this happen to begin with?
I love it. It happened by Ronald Reagan getting elected, Ronnie, and people buying into this whole right wing thing of trickle down economics. The bottom line is wealth is created at the bottom. In every economy that works, you make something of value, and that making things of value, as Lincoln pointed out, labor and capital together, and labor in fact precedes capital. Therefore, Lincoln said it was superior to capital. It's why he was the first president to actually prevent the military from breaking a strike. And as things are made of value, that creates value for the economy, and the economy grows. Starting in the 80s, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the largest manufacturer of finished goods in the world. We were the largest exporter of finished goods in the world. We were the largest importer of raw materials in the world. And we were the largest creditor nation in the world. We had the largest and strongest economy the world had ever seen. And so we imported the raw materials from other countries, we added labor to it and technology to it, and dramatically increased its value. We brought in steel ore and turned it into computers and cars, and then we shipped it out for a huge profit. And then we took that money and we loaned it to other countries and got back money and interest, and we even had so much money left over we could build factories in other countries. We were, as I said, the largest creditor. Now, 30 years later, 30 years of discredited trickle-down economic theory and 30 years of so-called free trade, where we went from an average of we have averaged import tariffs in the United States from 1787 until 1985 of 35%. That's been the average tariff. It's been as high as 45, it's been as low as 25, but it's averaged around 35%. Our average import tariff now is 2%, which means we threw open the doors and said to every manufacturing company in the United States, we don't need to make things here anymore. You can go make them in China. You'll make a whole lot more profit. So
yeah, yeah.
Off,
wait, listen. I want to make sure and elaborate on that point about China. They're sending over toys with lead in them, and we're selling them worthless securities.
I know.
But again, Tom, we got to step back and say we are spending the money on research and development. We are putting money in, Tom, to.
But we're not protecting the stuff when we make it. That's the problem. Ronnie, I think you're starting to agree with me. Am I starting to make sense to you?
Tom, listen, I think you're crazy most of the time, but there are things that I'm definitely agreeing with you on, and that is that we have a fundamental crisis here. And I want to step back and ask you, what are we going to build, Tom? What are we going to invent? We're spending $1 trillion saving the world. I'd like to hire every unemployed worker out there, Tom, for
yep.
that $1 trillion,
yep.
and I'd like them to invent the next big thing, Tom. Put
yep.
the money here.
Yes, absolutely. This is what Franklin Roosevelt did. What Franklin Roosevelt understood was that if you want to drive an economy, you drive the economy by putting money into the hands of people who will spend it. And so he created the WPA and the CCC, and he said, okay, we're going to put people to work, even if it's make work. We're going to have them plant trees. We're going to have them build bridges. We're going to have them build schools, even though we don't need them yet. We're going to have them build dams and power plants and things. We're going to have them, you know, and we're going to have artists do murals. and he put people to work where they could have some self-respect. That money then was in their pockets. They went to the local stores and they bought things. The local stores then went to the manufacturers and said, we want to buy things. And all of a sudden, the economy was working. It's the exact opposite of Reaganomics.
And it worked for 60 years. If we know we need to get money in the hands of consumers to spend, I'm completely on the same page. How do we accomplish that goal, though, Tom? If we're spending $1 trillion over there to make sure our buddies in China, Japan, and Russia get repaid and keep buying these worthless securities, how are we going to get the money in the hands of our consumers? If the banks aren't going to lend it, Tom, how are we going to do that? How are we going to accomplish
I would suggest to you, Ronnie, that if we simply pulled out of the WTO tomorrow and canceled NAFTA and all of these trade agreements that have dropped our tariffs and went back to just the trade deals that we had 20 years ago and just said, you know, we're just going to go back to the trade where there is some where if you want to import a pair of tennis shoes made in China, you're going to have to pay a fee at the border of the United States equal to the cost of if they had been made in the United States. A whole lot of manufacturing will come back to this country in a matter of months.
Okay, but Tom, listen, what about energy? Let's just stop for a moment and pretend that we had the money and the wherewithal to spend it there, to develop energy, Tom. That would create millions of jobs. You look at McCain and Obama. McCain wants to give $300 million to someone who creates and invents the next battery. Obama only wants to spend $150 billion over 10 years. Tom, we need more, and I think we could do that.
But see, I don't disagree with you, Ronnie, but here's the problem. Let's say that you or I or some other genius, you know, somebody in the garage comes up with the best idea in the world. Where are they going to make it? Here or in China?
And again, Tom, you and I know why they're going to China to make it, or they're going to Thailand, or wherever they're going. We know they're going to go offshore. But why not, Tom, induce them by keeping them here with tax credits, research and development? We've got to take a look again.
We've tried a variety of ways to do this over the last 240 years, Ronnie, and the one that has always consistently worked is import tariffs. It's why China right now, if you want to sell a car in China, you have to pay a 21% tax when you import that car into China. If China wants to sell a car in the United States, it's a 2% tax.
Wow.
China is protecting their economy. Japan has protected is still protecting their economy. Korea. Korea in 1960, the average income in Korea was under $400 a year, the average per capita income. Now it's close to us. Why? Because they protected their economy. They put up huge import tariffs. You know, Tom Friedman is so wrong in Olive Tree versus the Lexus. The Lexus is a result. Toyota used to be a loom manufacturer. Japan's major export was silk in the 1960s. The average per capita income was under $1,000 in 1960 in Japan. And with massive government subsidies and huge tariffs, they threw out, in the late 1950s, the Japanese threw out all the foreign car manufacturers. So that's it. You're going to make a car in Japan. You're going to sell a car in Japan. It's got to be made in Japan. And Toyota, they imported the Toyoped in 1961. It didn't go anywhere. They said, we're going to keep on working at it. And the Lexus is the result of an activist government intervention in the marketplace, producing wealth. And we've got to be doing the same thing in this country, in my humble
opinion. Yeah, but remember, Tom, we are a nation of Band-Aids. We're only looking for the Band-Aid to get us through that next painful situation. We are a country.
And you and I agree that that's just crazy. That's just crazy.
And I agree with protecting our economy, but I want to know, Tom, we need money right now. We need stimulus checks right now, Tom, because the plans that you have, they're going to take a long time.
Okay, here's two really simple things. Number one, raise the minimum wage tomorrow to $14 an hour. Number one, raise the minimum wage. And number two, extend unemployment benefits for 18 months.
Okay, so
that's going to put a whole bunch of money in a whole lot of people's pockets at the bottom. And that money is going to immediately go into the economy. And
remember what they've been doing, Tom, at the bottom level. We don't have unemployment benefits that have been extended. We do have low, you know, minimum wage. But I want to come back and say, as an employer, Tom, remember, I've got 150 employees. I'm building businesses. I want some tax credits, Tom. I want some French fries, and I want them supersized, and I want some health care tax credits.
Right, but wouldn't you love to have customers who have more money in their pockets to buy your services? It may cost you a little more to provide those services, but you're going to make more money from the customers because they have more money for the services. That's the upward spiral that Franklin Roosevelt started with unionization and hiring and creating the minimum wage.
Hey, did we love talking today or what, Tom? It's always a pleasure.
Okay, Ronnie Deutsch, RONIDEUTCH.com, the tax lady. Ronnie Deutsch, great talking with you, Ronnie.
Great talking to you, Tom. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. 17 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio. Stick around. We'll be back. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Shocked, totally shocked. Can't believe it. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. So, let me just add 2 points, and then we'll pick up your calls here. Number one, this from Kevin Phillips. He points out, since Reagan came into office over the last quarter century, total public and private credit market debt in the United States has more than quintupled from $8 to $48 trillion. Keep in mind, the GDP of the world is $60 trillion. There's now $48 trillion worth of debt in the United States. The money borrowed just by the financial sector, principally for leverage buyouts and basically deal-making, expansion, consolidation, empire-building, leveraging, gambling. I mean, I'm quoting Kevin Phillips, gambling, you name it, swelled from just $1 trillion to $14 trillion. Our GDP right now in the United States, 12% of our GDP is manufacturing, 21% is the financial services sector. That is nuts. And that's what's collapsing. It used to be the vast majority of GDP was manufacturing and farming. We made things and we grew things. And now China is saying, maybe we should reconsider the dollar. And I'm telling you, if the dollar stops being the currency of international exchange, and right now there's some very, very smart folks in Europe who are sitting around going, how can we make the euro replace the dollar? And there's some very smart folks in Riyadh saying, how can we make the real, is it real? Whatever it is, the currency of Saudi Arabia. Replace the dollar. They may even be sitting around the central bank in London, you know, saying, how can we get the pound to replace the dollar as the medium of exchange around the world? And the Chinese. This from Reuters. This is a quote from Vice Premier Wang Qishan. Okay? He's the number two guy in the Chinese government. Quote, the Chinese government is well aware of the fact that the United States, which is the world's largest developed country, and China, which is the world's largest developing country, should have constructive and cooperative economic and trade relations. And then he cited a July 2005 commentary. The commentary suggested China must, I'm quoting now from Reuters, must brace for grave economic fallout and look to alternatives, saying that the crisis brings to mind the Great Depression of the 1930s. By alternatives, they're talking about alternatives to the dollar. In fact, the headline of this article in Reuters is China paper offers or urges new currency order after financial tsunami. Bernie Sanders is saying the middle class shouldn't be bailing out the bankers. He's got details. We'll get to those a little later on in the program. In fact, Bernie's going to drop by tomorrow. He wants to share them with you. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, Tom. I've been watching Bloomberg News, you know, their business channel, and they had these Wall Street types on their talking heads bemoaning the fact that the Fed or the SEC has banned the selling of shorts, short selling,
right,
until October the 2nd. And they're saying that in no uncertain terms that the United States government should not do what Europe has done and ban short selling for a year.
Right.
I'm just kind of wondering what happens on October the 2nd when the ban on short selling is over with. It's
all hell breaks loose.
It's gambling. So it's like here you have these speculators, these casino gamblers, these addicted people that are saying, you know, they're the ones that are basically advising the politicians, oh, we can't be doing this, you know, we can't be banning the selling of short selling.
Right.
I think
selling, for our listeners who don't know, Anthony, is where you basically borrow a stock and then offer to sell it back at a lower price, and you make money if the value of the stock goes down. In other words, it's betting the market's going
to
drop.
I think that Chris Dodd is right. We got to have some regulation.
Yeah. No, absolutely. We, as I said to Ronnie, we need to just go back to 1980. Where were things at in 19? Thank you very much, Anthony. Where were things at in 1980? How are we regulating banks? How are we regulating mortgage companies? How are we regulating insurance companies? How are we regulating debt?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Last Friday we had Robbie Batron for an hour, the economist from Southern Methodist University, professor of economics, New York Times, and internationally best-selling author of a number of books, including my favorites, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age. And Robbie had mentioned that he felt that, this is my recollection of what he said, that he felt that basically what they were trying to do here is buy a couple of weeks. And so I wanted to get Robbie back, and let's just clarify that. Robbie Batra, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. What has happened is I have received a few emails, especially this morning, saying that I'm predicting a collapse coming up in 2 weeks. And they're saying that I said that on your show Friday.
Right.
And I said, no, that was misunderstanding. What I said was they're buying 2 or 3 weeks. And the government is buying 2 or 3 weeks with all this bailout.
Right.
And then bad things will start happening soon, especially because the oil price will start rising again.
Yeah.
And here you go. Today oil is up $3. Friday itself oil was up $6, so it's now back to 108.
And gold is up over 900 again.
Okay.
And aren't these really signs that everybody is around the world is looking at what this administration is doing to our dollar and what 30 years of Reaganomics and trickle-down economics and particularly Alan Greenspan's policies have done to the dollar, and they're saying, I'm going to get out of dollars?
Well, not only that, this is a sign that these people still don't get it. They are just looking again only at the symptoms of the problem, not at the cause. The cause is all this speculation, all this mismanagement. And I've heard that George Bush is threatening to veto a bill against speculation. That's what I heard, that the House wants to pass a bill against speculation, and George Bush is threatening to veto that bill. And I said to myself, these people still don't get it, how bad things are. So that's why I predicted on your show that speculation is going to come back, and that means oil will start rising again, gold will start coming back, and so on. And that's what's happening. But I'm not predicting a collapse yet.
No. When are you predicting a collapse?
No, I just said it. For 2 or 3 weeks, they'll buy some time, and then panic will start setting. But panic doesn't mean collapse, not a crash. I think that will come next year sometime.
So next year sometime you're
predicting a crash. Or it could come after the election. Because remember, they are very concerned about this election.
Yeah, see, I think that they're just trying to buy enough time to get us to November 4th.
Exactly. And so after November 4th, I don't know what they'll do. So it could things could really fall sharply at that time, right after that. But I don't think there's a collapse is imminent.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Dr. Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com. Let me highly recommend, again, people check out your website, and if you have not read Ravi Batra's books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, you are not economically literate. You have to get these books. Dr. Batra, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom, again.
Great talking with you today. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just kind of amused how the corporate media keeps going to the same pundits that have been espousing this unregulated free market. And John Boehner was on TV this morning saying that he wants that $700 billion bailout. The best thing to do is have it come fast and no strings attached. I'll just let you rant on that now.
Right.
Got to come fast, no strings attached. Let's
there you go.
Just flowing, boys.
Right. Just give us the money. That's all we want. We just want to see. Give us the money. Thanks a lot, Lee. I think it's incredible. You know, the no strings attached is their way of saying we don't want to help the average person. We don't want to help Main Street. We only want to help Wall Street. Right. That's what they're all about. That's what these guys are saying. And I hope the American people are paying close attention and are getting what's going on here. Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank.
While I was listening to you, I just happened to notice an ad on the back of, I have something else about the economy, but on Money Magazine, someone gave me a copy. On the back it says AIG, an ad, and it says, add 8 years to your life when you prepare for retirement with AIG.
Oops.
I think they lost about 8 years, people that have investments in it.
That's tragic. That's tragic.
And this is the current issue. Let's see, it's... October.
Yeah.
But anyways, what I wanted to talk about, Rush Limbaugh said that Roosevelt is dead and the New Deal will soon be dead. The Republicans want to replace it with what they call the raw deal. And you could see that with these bailouts, deregulation, no oversight, privatizing the government. You know, by privatizing the government, it's costing the taxpayer approximately about three times what it would cost if the government did the same job.
Right. And we've seen this in Iraq, where you got all these private contractors paying people $150,000 a year to do what GIs could do for a fifth of that, and doing it poorly, doing it in ways that electrocutes our GIs and kills them and gives them sewage instead of water. And yeah, it's you're absolutely right, Frank. They want to do a raw deal, not a new deal.
Roosevelt is dead.
Oh, no.
His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yes, Rush, and isn't it working out well, what you guys have been doing for the last 30 years? Isn't it working out so very, very well? Well, 28 years, I guess we can say, 27 years, arguably. Oh, my. Suzanne in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Suzanne.
Hi, Tom. I love your show. Thanks so much for everything that you do. My question about the growing homeless problem that we never see on the television, people who don't have homes can't vote. And would we be better to go to just needing a Social Security number to be able to vote or some other solution?
Well, technically, if you don't have a home, you can still vote. You just have to prove some sort of residence someplace. It varies from state to state, the rules on how you demonstrate that you're a resident of that state. But you have to at that particular voting precinct.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in some states it would be much more difficult for homeless people. The only problem with that solution, Suzanne, is that you would then be basically federalizing the elections. And the Constitution is really clear that power really, the majority of power should rest within the states. The states decide how they do their educational policy. The states decide how they do their, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, this was the big objection, by the way, of the Republicans to Social Security, was that it jumped over the top of the states. But in any case, with regard to the elections, we'd have to have a major realignment, a recalibration in the United States and federalize our elections. And I'm not sure with Rove and Bush and this gang around that I would be willing to trust that to them right now.
Right. Yeah, that's tricky. You know, it's just such a transient population right now. And, you know, we're getting Hoovervilles. We're not seeing it on the television. But
yep.
I did speak to a lady, Lisa, with the New Mexico Coalition Against Homeless. And are you there?
Yeah, I am.
She was saying that, you know, the long-term solution is affordable housing.
Yep.
And, you know, there are some strides being made, but it's people really taking action. It's not just emergency shelters that we need, but, you know, a big, big plan. to take care of the, you know.
We are.
I like the idea of raising the minimum wage to $14 an hour. I mean, I work my hands to the bone, and I'm making less than $13 an hour, which is kind of what I made in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's absurd. Right. People should not be, you know, working for a wage that you can't live on. I mean, that's the bottom line. We need to have to quote the Republican Teddy Roosevelt, we need a living wage in the United States. He was the guy who invented that phrase.
Right.
And we absolutely need to do it. Suzanne, I've got to move along, but I appreciate your call. Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody.
Good morning. Yes, I'm going to try a pitch again that I talked to you about with Senator Sanders on the line, and that was for the subprime mortgage where Lehman Brothers just sold their mortgages for 22 cents on the dollar.
Yep.
Let the borrower pay 27 cents or even 32 cents, between a nickel and a dime more. They get their mortgage reset. They don't have the cash. They'll go to a lender who will then make a more secure loan with higher equity.
Yep.
Getting back to some of the other comments about affordability.
Yeah, let me just turn that into common English, I think, Woody, for our listeners. If there's a bunch of shaky debt out there, a bunch of shaky mortgages that the government is going to buy or banks are going to sell for 25 cents on the dollar, and one of those mortgages happens to be, say, mine, for example, let me buy that for 25 cents on the dollar.
Right.
Let me buy back my own mortgage for 25 cents on the dollar, and then I'll pay it off, you know, over time or whatever, or I'll go find a bank that'll buy it from me for 35 cents on the dollar. And
right.
Because it's still worth, you know, the dollar, and assuming that I'm willing to pay for it. And, or if the terms are changed, maybe the bank will pay 50 cents on the dollar when they buy it from me. But let me make the profit on that rather than, say, for example, Morgan Stanley.
Yes, because who else has the, you know, that kind of cash to put, like in the new century, $58
right.
million to buy $170 million worth of mortgages.
Right.
Some of the other aspects, when we talk about prices, I'm a real estate appraiser for 30 years now with Farmers Home and now Rural Development Farm Service Agency. But in Maricopa County, the Phoenix metropolitan area, 2006, median home price was $263. Median family household income was still only $53. I don't have the current household income, but I know the median price has dropped to about $203,000. But that's still four times what the median family income is. We go
right.
with this program. Again, many of those people that were hurt in the subprime will actually have a mortgage more approximate in their income levels, and then that's how we can just start stimulating economies.
Right, just sell the mortgage back to them. But see, that's going to require that all of those bundled mortgages get unbundled.
Yeah.
And they have been bundled, in many cases, they've been bundled intentionally in a way that obscures all the contents of that bundle so that if China was buying $1 billion worth of mortgages or $100 billion worth of mortgages, they didn't realize what was in there. And
right.
unbundling those could be a very expensive, complex, and time-consuming task. I mean, basically, what's happened is the thieves have gotten in, they've raided the hen house, they've got all the eggs and ran off with them, and we're sitting around going, what are we going to do? That's an imperfect metaphor, but it's close. I don't know. And I'll tell you what we need to do. We need to get more eggs in the hen house. Bernie Sanders is actually suggesting, he's got a four-part plan. He says, anybody who's earning over $500,000 a year, 10% surtax.
Yeah.
Use that money.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, protecting America from the weapons of mass deception. I'm telling you, there's a bunch of them out there. Scott in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just wanted to, I do a lot of canvassing for the campaign on the
mm-hmm.
weekends, and when you talk about deregulation, you get a lot of blank stares, and
right.
I found that a lot of times you compare it to a football game. That people get it. If you If you were to take all the rules out of a football game, an already brutal game, and let these guys go at it however they wanted, a lot of guys are really going to get hurt, and it might become a very unpopular game, and I don't think anybody in their right mind would play it.
Yeah. Well said. That's brilliant. Scott, thank you very much. That's absolutely brilliant. Michael in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I haven't spoken to you in about a couple of months, but I wanted to refer to a book by Rick Shankman, who from George Mason University's History News Network. And his book, I think, would be good for a lot of listeners, especially as it relates to the financial crisis we're dealing with here. Just how stupid are we facing the truth about the American voter?
Right.
And
we actually had the guy on as a guest on the show about 6 months ago when the book came out. And you know, it's I get it, and also I get it that in some ways, you know, we've lost critical thinking skills. Our education system has, in some regards, failed us and things like that. But also, a lot of people are just working too hard. I mean, it's just the bottom line. 30 years of Republican economic policies has led to half of all the children in America coming home to an empty home because both people, everybody's working. Most people are working two or three jobs, too many people are working two or three jobs. And as a result, they can't pay attention to what's going on. Speaking of what's going on, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you very much. Really, I think if I were to sum up what's going on, and it is completely, people are completely obsessed with this bailout, is Barney Frank has been saying that he wants to talk about limiting executive compensation on this.
Right.
And apparently this is causing the deadlock in the legislation that was sent to Congress.
I love it. So Barney Frank is saying, okay, we're going to make sure that the CEOs who have been making, been paying themselves 10, 20, 30 million bucks a year, in some cases over $100 million a year, Hank Paulson himself made $17 million for 6 months' work as the head of, was it Morgan Stanley that he came from, as I recall?
No,
it was Goldman Sachs.
Right, okay. Get me on that one.
Yeah, 17 million bucks was Paulson's paycheck for his 6 months. And they knew he was on his way into Treasury. So it's like, yeah, here you go, Hank, we'll pay you forward. Or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it was just a coincidence. But anyhow, so Barney Frank says, let's not give these guys who brought us this economic disaster more of these huge paychecks. And many of them have contracts where they have golden parachutes. You know, if they get fired or quit for any reason, they get, you know, the corporate jet for the rest of their life, plus $10 million a year for the rest of their life, plus, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
And Barney Frank says, we're gonna take that away from them. And the Republicans, of course, are going, what? You're going to take away things from our primary campaign contributors?
Well, I mean, when you realize, you know, it was interesting because I was to our mutual friend and my partner, Shalene Espinoza, and she, of course, is sitting there with the Dubai perspective. And she's saying, hey, executive compensation, I bet. And then, lo and behold, you know, Barney Franks, 10 minutes later, gets on and starts to talk about the deadlock on the legislation because of this issue.
It is such a great way to show Americans the difference between Republicans and Democrats in this election cycle. That the Democrats are saying, yeah, we're fine with a bailout. We realize there's a disaster caused by 30 years of Republican policies, and we're okay with a bailout. We just want to make sure that it helps the little person, the average person, or at the very least, that the guys who screwed things up so badly don't walk off with even more. And the Republicans are like, no, can't have that.
And the way that this is somewhat being sold is by saying that the G7 finance ministers had a conference call, and they decided, they issued a statement saying they reaffirm our strong and shared commitment to protect the integrity of the international financial system. So they've got the G7 on board.
Well, that's because this $800 billion is not just to bail out American banks. It's also to bail out Chinese banks and Japanese banks and German banks and British banks and French banks and Swiss banks in particular. It's mind-boggling. So, you have one of the best political ears of anybody I know, and you know a lot of these folks in ways that many reporters don't. What's your sense, Ellen Ratner, of where this is going to go? How do you think it's going to play out?
Well, I think that the Democrats they've got the Democrats backed up because, you know, they're saying the Democrats won't bail them out. But, of course, this is one, interestingly enough, in terms of what we're hearing from Talkers Magazine on the talk show hosts, mm-hmm. some of the right-wing talk show hosts are as outraged about this as the left-wings.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So if they think that they're somehow going to put the Democrats into a, you know, into a box on this, they're absolutely wrong.
So you don't
think that the Republican, I think talk show hosts are no more interested, and the Republican right is no more interested in seeing an immediate bailout, when the American people have not gotten a chance to, vet it and look at it. I think, the guys that are putting this through fast may be on thinner ice than they think.
Very, very interesting. So the Democrats won't flinch?
Well, they may flinch, but I think that the executive...
They don't have to?
But I think they know on the executive compensation side, they do have the American people on their side.
What about reintroducing regulation?
Well, of course, the Democrats are saying that they want to do this, but that's not going to happen immediately in a week bailout before they leave. That is going to happen if we get a new administration and a new Congress. We're not going to see new regulation happen overnight.
Yeah. It's really a breathtaking and incredible thing. And it's what's even more incredible is that this administration basically sat on their hands for the last couple of years as this thing built up and did nothing. Just said, good times are here. Maybe they were waiting for a Democrat to be elected so they could drop the ball. And it just happened 6 months earlier than they thought.
Right.
Ellen Radner, thanks so much. TalkRadioNews.com. Good talking with you, Ellen. Stick around. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, and one of the really good guys in the Clinton administration, by the way. I don't, frankly, have much use for Larry Summers and some of the other folks who surrounded Bill Clinton, who were the conservative economic ideologues, Alan Greenspan and whatnot. But Robert Reich was definitely a good guy. He's been on the show a number of times. He's written some brilliant books. And he's laid out five things that Wall Street should do to get its blank check. You can find it over at talkingpointsmemo.com. And he says the government, that is the taxpayers, should get an equity stake in every Wall Street financial company proportional to the amount of bad debt that company shoves onto the public. In other words, the more money we give a bank or a brokerage house or an insurance company, we get a piece of their stock. So when they're back together again, when they're functional, when their shares rise, we, the people, can sell that stock and get some of our money back. Number one. Number two, Wall Street executives and directors of Wall Street firms relinquish their current stock options and this year's other forms of compensation and agree to future compensation linked to a rolling five-year average of firm profitability. Why should taxpayers feather their already amply feathered nests? All of these guys are millionaires. Many of them multi-millionaires, probably a few of them even billionaires. Number three, all Wall Street executives immediately cease making campaign contributions to any candidate for public office in this election cycle or next. All Wall Street PACs be closed, political action committees, and Wall Street lobbyists curtail their activities unless specifically asked for information by policymakers. Why should taxpayers finance Wall Street's outsized political power, Robert Reich writes, especially when that power is being exercised to get favorable terms from taxpayers? Number four, Wall Street firms agree to comply with new regulations over disclosure, capital requirements, conflicts of interest, and market manipulation. He says, let's convene a working group on this within 90 days, bipartisan working group on this within 90 days, have new oversight. I mean, we're not reinventing the wheel here. Or I guess we are reinventing. No, the wheel's there. All we have to do is look back at what worked from 1935 until the 1980s when Reagan and his buddies started taking this stuff apart. And number five, Wall Street agrees to give bankruptcy judges the authority to modify the terms of primary mortgages so homeowners have a fighting chance to keep their homes. Why should distressed homeowners lose their homes when Wall Streeters receive taxpayer money that helps them keep their fancy homes? Sounds good to me. Robert Reich. Another brilliant, brilliant analysis. Andre in Washington, D.C. Hey, Andre, what's on your mind today?
Hey, buddy, two things. I was wondering, what does it mean for us? You mentioned this earlier about if the world currency, the world no longer uses the dollar as a form of the major currency. What would happen, for example, to our oil prices if, for example, oil is now traded in euros? And last but not least, in terms of everything that's going on right now in Wall Street, you argue the point that folks just wait until November 4th, you know, this is like a bandage until November 4th. And if it is exactly that, and I'm not even saying it isn't, I agree with you, but why wouldn't Obama fight back and say, you know, listen, this is just a bandage? Because I can only imagine if he got elected, you know, the next 4 years is just going to be, you know, unbelievably bad, and yeah, has nothing to do with him, but it is right. What it is. And, you know, 4 years after that, I can see Republicans, you know, using that to their advantage.
Yeah, and they will certainly try. You know, at least in the 1932 election, the Great Depression was already 2.5 years in, and a Republican had been at the helm, Herbert Hoover, and it was obvious that the Republicans, who had also controlled the House and Senate at the time, were responsible, you know. They will certainly try to blame this on Obama if he's elected, and I think that the chances are looking pretty good. But I don't think it's going to stick, frankly. I think everybody gets it, that this whole discredited, you know, laissez-faire policy, Republican policy, is down the tubes. With regard to what will happen to the dollar if we're no longer the international exchange currency, if oil is no longer denominated in dollars, we as a nation will become much poorer, and everything that we import right now very cheaply will become much more expensive. And over the short term, it'll just mean you'll see an explosion basically in poverty in the United States. The cost of living will dramatically increase, but revenues will not increase with that cost of living, because we don't make things here anymore. We have lost the ability to generate wealth, and so we've been borrowing wealth.
So that $35,000 BMW now become a $55,000 BMW?
That's right. And the $50,000 paycheck, I think the average American now is $42,500 or something like that, will become a $38,000 paycheck. And so we're just going to get much poorer. And that's what happens during recessions. It's what happened during the Great Depression. It'll probably happen much faster and farther. This is what Brazil went through in the 70s. It's what Argentina went through. It's what Chile went through. It's what Mexico went through. We've seen this happen in other countries. It's what Thailand went through. George Soros made a fortune on that.
Why did Argentina? I remember Argentina having something a couple of years ago. Was it the same? Why did they end up having to go through that?
The secondary problems, the primary problems that they went through had to do with, and actually I shouldn't say, because I'm not an expert on Argentina,
sure,
what happened there, but my recollection is that, you know, the right-wing coup, the right-wing takeover, basically screwed their economy, and a whole bunch of people went in and ripped everything off. But then the IMF came along and said, yes, we will loan you money and bail you out, but you have to privatize Social Security, and which was a disaster in Chile when they did it. And you've got to do all these, you know, put on what Thomas Friedman calls the golden straitjacket. And that was incredibly destructive to that economy. This whole experiment in neoliberalism, this whole experiment in laissez-faire economics. Andre, I got to move along, but
thanks, buddy.
Thank you. Good questions and things we all need to think about. Frank in Staten Island. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind?
Why hasn't anybody made an issue about Mr. McCain's plan to tax your medical benefit so that you could go out into the private market and buy it on your own? I challenge Mr. McCain and his running mate, who has a Down syndrome child, to go out into the private market and try to buy insurance on our own. I think it'll never happen.
No, he's uninsurable. He's had cancer, and he's had cancer several times.
But his running mate, Ms. Palin, has a Down syndrome child. There's no way that she's going to go out and get insurance in the private market.
Right. Neither one of them can.
And so, what's the benefit of quote, dropping the controls or the monitors on health plan to make it, you know, more competitive?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. The Democrats should be making more of this. And maybe they plan to drop this as a bomb in the last week or two before the election. I don't know. But I think that they should be hitting them very hard, because you're absolutely right. McCain's plan to tax your health benefits is crazy. It doesn't solve any problems at all. It's just the bottom line. Wanda in Chandler, Arizona, listening to KPHX. Hey, Wanda.
Yeah, hi there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm kind of a simple person, so I've tried to figure this bailout thing the best that I can, and I know that they're coming to us taxpayers. My question is, every dime that us taxpayers are sending in right now has already been spent, and we're in a deficit.
Right.
So if the Republicans who got us into this mess was their massive greed, if they really want us taxpayers to bail them out, then I think the Democrats need to hold their feet to the fire on this bailout and simply say that George Bush needs to go in front of the American public and declare that taxes are going to go up across the board effective immediately.
Right.
Because that
Or another way to say it, Wanda, and perhaps a more politically appropriate and palatable way, is to say this must be fully funded. George Bush has to come before the American taxpayers and tell them how he is going to fund this. Because he has some choices. We have a $500 billion military budget. there's a couple things he can cut if he wanted to.
If he wanted to, right.
Yeah.
But it goes to the point where John McCain says the surge is working, and it will continue to work as long as we're willing to throw the $10 billion a month to Iraq.
Yeah, well, and in fact, there's a lot of evidence that this has nothing to do with the surge. The satellite photos now are showing that about that, actually it was a little before the surge, that we were clearing Sunni areas of Baghdad, and the lights were literally going out. I mean, entire neighborhoods that used to be problematic for us just got wiped out. People just got moved out. There's 4.5 million refugees. We have had ethnic cleansing, violent ethnic cleansing in Iraq, and that's what's led to the majority of the reduction of violence. Joe Biden actually suggested early on that we should partition Iraq, that there should be.
Oh, absolutely.
But it should be done in a way that was reasonable and fair. And if, you know, a Sunni family moves out of a Shia neighborhood and into a Sunni neighborhood, they get compensated for their house, and let's do it right. And of course, it didn't get done that way. Instead, they simply got murdered, run out of town. And so you've got thank you, Wanda. So you've got 4.5 million refugees now in Iraq. 2.5 million outside the country, 2 million inside the country, or maybe it's the other way around. And it's an absolute screaming disaster. You get a lot of refugees, a little less violence, but this is no way can we call this a success.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
By the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. Well, George W. Bush laid it out. Here's what Bush had to say. I guess not. It's gibberish. Thea Lee is with us. Thea is the policy director of the AFL-CIO. Thea, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to set you up there with that because it was George Bush. The clip that I thought I had was George Bush back when he said, "With a $500 million tax break, we will create 500,000 new jobs." And first of all, you know, you do the math, and it's like, wait a minute, we're paying $500,000 per job or something like that. but secondly, it just hasn't quite worked out. All this right wing stuff that we've been seeing ever since 1980, ever since the election of Reagan, the deconstruction of labor, the destruction of organized labor, the destruction of the American middle class, all of our jobs, not all of them, many of our jobs going overseas, it just isn't working, is it?
It's been a pretty rough couple of decades, I have to say.
Yeah, and now comes along this administration with this bailout. Does the AFL-CIO? AFLCIO.org, by the way, the website. Does the AFL-CIO have a position on this, or do you personally have thoughts on this bailout that's being proposed?
We absolutely have a position, and we are very engaged with Congress right now because this is a whole lot of money at stake here, and the you know, the stakes are very high for working families because, on the one hand, you know, none of us can afford to see the entire economy melt down, and nobody wants to see that. On the other hand, how we proceed is extremely important, and we have said that any kind of bailout needs to have a whole lot of accountability. We should have unions and other citizens at the table along with Wall Street there. We want to make sure that we are bailing out Main Street and not just Wall Street, that we are actually investing in the productive part of the economy, in the manufacturing sector, and people who are actually producing things for a living. And we want to make sure that any bailout also helps people stay in their homes, that it isn't just about saving the bankers who made the bad loans in the first place, but it's also about helping Americans stay in their homes because that's what we need for the stability and to get the economy back on its feet. So we've laid down a whole set of conditions, and we are very engaged right now because we don't want to see this bailout go forward with no strings attached.
Yeah. It's like the realization of Jefferson's worst nightmare. Here we are handing to one man with a law that explicitly says that there will be no oversight by either the legislative branch or the judicial branch, the judicial branch of the government. No oversight. Basically, we're handing the money to an agent of the President of the United States.
Because they've done such a good job so far with our money.
That's right. And in fact, we're not even actually handing him money. We're handing him a loan that we're borrowing from our children and grandchildren without having consulted them. Because if the Republicans were at all honest about this, they would say, okay, we need to raise taxes a little bit to generate $800 billion in revenue so that we can pass it out to our buddies in the banks. And they're not talking about that.
No, you're absolutely right. This initial plan that's been put forward by Secretary Paulson is a non-starter. It is appalling that he thinks that we would give almost $1 trillion to him to play with as he sees fit without any kind of oversight, without any kind of conditions here. We want to make sure. I mean, these folks made a hash out of the economy. You know, they took our money. They made terrible, terrible loans. They leveraged themselves up to the neck. And now they come running to the government to say, gee, we need some help here. We've gotten ourselves in some trouble. And they gave themselves these enormous bonuses. They were living high off the hog, buying them yachts and jewels and big houses, mansions, and so on.
Private
so
jets.
We need to make sure that, you know, that there is some pain on the people who made the bad decisions, that they need to take the losses, not the taxpayers.
And yet we were talking with Ellen Ratner earlier with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. She's an accredited White House reporter, and she said that the Bush administration has already said that if there is any attempt at regulation attached to the legislation, that Bush will veto it.
Well, that's just nonsense. That's just nonsense, and we need Congress
crazy.
To stand firm right now.
Yeah,
but
the Democrats have this long history of wimping out, even when they hold all the cards. I mean, this is the administration coming hat in hand saying, we need money, please.
And it's not just a little bit of money. We're not talking about, you know, a couple of bucks to run down to the store and buy a carton of milk.
Right.
We're talking about, honestly, about $1 trillion if you take, you know, not just this bailout, but the Fannie and Freddie and
About $3,000 for every, if I'm doing my math right, about $3,000 for every person in the United States, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not chump change here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the idea that they would say to Democrats, you can't hold it up, you can't put conditions, is just absurd. This is a moment where there's too much at stake here.
There absolutely is. And people can read all about it over at AFLCIO.org. I'm assuming you've got...
They certainly can. We've got a whole bunch up on the web.
Great. Thea Lee, the policy director of the AFL-CIO. Keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for dropping by. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Be back with your calls. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi. There's also a link to our Tom video, our free video stream, also over at AirAmerica.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Uh-oh. It's our full Monty alert.
Baby, take off your shoes. I'll take your shoes. Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can't leave your hat on.
Leave your hat on. A lawyer was suspended for more than a year for accepting nude dances as partial payment for the legal fees that a woman owed him. Scott Robert Irwin, who practices in the northern Illinois city of DeKalb, and his client mutually agreed that she'd perform nude dances for him in his office as a way to reduce her legal fees. He credited her with $534 towards his bill. Mm-hmm. And here's a tip. Bartending nude can get you arrested. Delhi, Illinois. Sheriff deputies doing a routine check this week at a southern Illinois bar say they discovered a not-so-routine sight. They allege that 33-year-old Janet Brannon was naked while serving bar patrons at the Cabin Tavern in Delhi, Illinois. Very interesting. And what does Dick Cheney know that the rest of us don't know? I mean, maybe this is a piggies alert. Yes, the bigger piggies in their starched white shirts. The Cheneys, according to their recent financial disclosure forms, required by, you know, law, have $10 to $25 million invested in the American Century International Bond. This is a fund that says in its prospectus it will never expose you to more than 25% of assets in dollars and currently has only 6% of its assets in dollars. Most of its money is in high-quality foreign bonds, predominantly European bonds. So the Cheneys are getting out of dollars. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Michael in Templeton, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. What's happening with this particular bailout can be further illuminated if you look back into financial history. Because people have heard of this and the savings and loan thing. But actually, this is the seventh time in the last 25 years that the whole financial system, a large part of it, or a major player in it, whose demise could cause a contagion, has either been directly bailed out or had a rescue arranged for it. And what this has done is it's created this large entitlement mentality on Wall Street.
Yeah.
They always figure that they can get away with it.
Okay, you said the seventh time. I remember the bailout of Chrysler. I remember the SNL bailout during the last Bush administration.
Well, I'm not talking about Chrysler. I'm talking about the financial sector.
Okay. So
I can run them down if you want.
Yeah, if you would, I'd love to hear.
Okay, the first one is the petrodollar loans that went to Latin American countries.
Right.
That started going south when Mexico had a crisis in 1982.
Yep.
Fed insolvent banks in the United States, fed in the Treasury to the rest. October 19th, 1987, Greenspan floods the stock market with liquidity to stop the market from totally crashing.
After Black Tuesday or whatever it was.
Right. The savings and loan thing. Okay,
yeah.
Here's one that not many people know about. 1991, Citibank is on its knees because of all of its junk bond investments that went south. The stock is down to $2.
Right.
Greenspan arranges for a Saudi Arabian billionaire to come in and put money into them to rescue them because this is too big to fail thing. Okay?
Right, but he and that Saudi Arabian billionaire ended up owning 7 or 9% of Citibank as a result of that, did he not?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they did it really quietly because it was right after the Gulf War. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. 1995, the bailout of the Mexican bondholders. Remember that?
Yep.
The Mexico deregulates their financial system after NAFTA. All this foreign money comes pouring in for these high percentage bonds called Tesa Bonos, and then another Mexican peso crisis, everything starts going south. Okay, then they come to the Congress to ask for money. The Congress doesn't want to give them any money. But Robert Rubin and Greenspan get together and they find $50 billion in some treasury fund and they bail out all of these people. Okay, 1998, long-term capital management. Everything
right.
they have in it long-term is a template for what's happening now. When
you're absolutely right.
Okay, now today. And every time they do this, they get bailed out, but no structure is put on them to change their behavior. So it's a demonstration of their political power because nobody just stops them from doing it again, so they go ahead and do it again, and it gets worse each time.
And you're absolutely right. And this is why it is so wise what Robert Reich is recommending is that they be forbidden by law from asserting political power, that they not be allowed to lobby Congress for the next 5 years, that they not be allowed to have any political action committees, that we just say, that's it, guys. You've had too much influence in Washington, D.C. Excellent point, Michael. Thank you very much for sharing that, and thanks for the great history. I appreciate it. Elliot in Novi, Michigan. Hey, Elliot.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Tom, and thanks for everything you do.
Sure.
Two things. First, it's pretty clear to me, and I guess to lots of other people as well, that the bailout here is a clear hustle. A man comes to you and says, I want to borrow some money. You say, how much money? He says, well, I don't know. He says, well, what kind of trouble are you in? He says, well, I don't know, but if you give me $700 billion, I think I can make it work.
Right.
This is not much different.
Yeah.
There was a comment made this morning on MSNBC that the United Arab Emirates chief of finance is looking for his capital back. That is to say, the money that they've already invested in a variety of Wall Street houses because
right.
they're afraid they're at risk.
Right, and they are. And they are.
And they are. And
Paulson
Chinese,
made clear on
and,
TV on Sunday and, was that we're not just going to be bailing out U.S. banks. We're going to be bailing out foreign investors. We're going to be buying those equities back from them. And my guess is that the foreign investors that we're the most concerned about, which would be probably Saudi Arabia and China, we're going to be going to them and saying, listen, you bought $100 billion worth of bad bonds. We'll buy them back from you for $100 billion. Don't worry. We'll take the risk. We'll dump it on the taxpayer. And then we'll sell them in the secondary market for $10 billion or $20 billion. And then, you know, and somebody will buy them like that, unpackage them, figure out a way to make a small profit on them, and on it'll go.
Except for Robert Reich's conditions, this entire bailout needs to be rejected out of hand.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. Very well said. And Robert Reich has just nailed it. And as I said, you can read the thing over at talkingpointsmemo.com. It really is good. Is it Sudi in South
yes,
San Francisco?
Yes, hi. Is this Tom?
It is. You're on
hi,
the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, guess what? I've been a fan of your books through the years, but this is my first day on your radio show.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, and I'm just an innocent, you know, regular person that saved some money, and I saw the market going down, and especially after the whole Bear Stearns thing, I bought, guess what, an ETF index fund that shorts the QID. And so my question is, should people who have taken a position in these ETF index funds, should they get out? Because I heard what you said earlier about the derivatives market kind of maybe drying up because of the hedge funds and their problems, because they don't actually short the market. They do derivatives and swaps and all that kind of deal.
Right.
So
and it's the derivatives and swaps that are disintegrating because so many
yeah,
of them are
and
bets
so,
against
you know,
bets
I'll lose
against
money
bets.
By getting out now, but will I lose more by waiting? It's so
I honestly don't know the answer to your question. I'm a lousy investor myself. I've not learned that much about investing. I'm not particularly sophisticated with regard to how to invest money. I've earned a lot of it over the years and spent a lot of it over the years.
Yeah.
But I'm not. I mean, you're,
but it sounds like you think the derivatives are going to go.
I am of the opinion. Well, it depends on the extent to which these guys bail them all out. But I mean, if the International Bank of Settlements is correct, and there's a $1,000 trillion worth of derivatives out there floating around.
Uh huh.
I mean, and there's only $60 trillion in the entire gross domestic product of the entire planet.
Uh-huh.
That means that there's a lot of stuff that has been made out of nothing.
There's just
a whole lot of nothing out there in the derivatives markets. And that's the bubble that's bursting. In fact, let me just quickly reference, if I can find it here, this it's called The Web of Death. This is a really great article by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And it's at webofdebt.com is where you can probably find it. Just look for her article called It's the Derivatives Stupid, Why Fannie, Freddie, and AIG All Had to Be Bailed Out. And, you know, it might give you some insight. How to translate that into personal investment stuff, I don't know. I've been out of the stock market for a long, long time.
So would you think that the index gold funds could be a problem down the line, too, instead of just old
economic
gold?
My personal guess is that commodities, particularly gold and oil, are going to go up simply because they're counter cyclical to the dollar.
I agree with that, but you see, they keep changing the rules, and then if things go up too fast, that jeopardizes the dollar, and so they, they can control the indexes
Exactly, and there's no way to know what's going to happen after the election. I mean, to the extent that we are invested personally, Louise and I, it is in commodities, and we sold half of, we just turned half of everything we had into cash a couple of weeks ago because the market was just getting too crazy for me. So anyhow, I gotta move along. But thank you for the call. Good to hear from you, Roland in Portland. Hey, Roland, what's up?
Hey, you had said that if we just went back to 1980s in terms of the regulatory structure, that we'd be a lot better off. And I agree with you, but I think you're overlooking a really important historical event in 1971. And
Nixon taking us off the gold standard.
When Nixon pulled out of the Bretton Woods Agreement and the gold standard, right?
Right.
When Nixon came out of the Bretton Woods Agreement, that really is what allowed finance to run wild. Before then, sort of monetary policies between countries were controlled. International investment was really tightly regulated, and it was only when that sort of dissolved.
Roland, we're out of time, but thank you very much for that. I'm going to have to look into that.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at HartmanRadio.com.
Talking about Bretton Woods, I knew that Nixon had pulled us off the gold standard in 71. I didn't get the connection to Bretton Woods. I just checked it out during the break. And this is fascinating. The Bretton Woods Agreement was what established essentially the gold standard. It said that every country had to peg its currency within plus or minus 1% of the relative value of other currencies and relative to the relative to gold. And Nixon's pulling the U.S. off the gold standard in 71 caused that part of the Bretton Woods Agreement essentially to collapse. And so because countries were no longer pegging their currency against gold, they started pegging them against the dollar. And thus the dollar became the default reserve currency around the world and still is. And I would suggest that, although this isn't in the little short history that I was perusing during the break, this wasn't said, but I would guess that the reason why is because we've succeeded in essentially forcing the major oil producers of the world to agree to sell their oil in dollars. And should that change, then our ability to control the reserve currency of the world may change. We'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out. Isaac in Miami. Hey, Isaac, what's on your mind today? Isaac? No, Isaac. Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've been hearing a lot about all of this bailout. And in some of the discussion, there's been discussion about protecting homeowners who've been victims of all this speculation over the last 10 years. But I haven't heard anything about all of the poor people. I work with people with disabilities, and the average cost in many parts of the country for a one-bedroom apartment are as much as 1.5 times the amount of a Social Security check. The average is only around 70%. But the speculation in the housing market has caused rents to go up and up and up. Mm-hmm. And for people who are on fixed incomes, they have really been the victims of this, and I hear nothing about helping the BLM out.
Yeah, well said, Mike. And in fact, to extend that, if you've, Kevin Phillips wrote a brilliant piece about this for The Atlantic 4, 5, 6 months ago. The way that we calculate inflation now is relatively meaningless, and we do it in order to prevent the automatic adjuster, the inflation adjuster for Social Security from going up to prevent Social Security payments from going up. So they don't really look at things like the cost of fuel or the cost of medicine or the cost of food, things that people on Social Security actually need. And they, in fact, deflate inflation when computers become, if the processing power of computers doubles and the price halves, then they'll say, okay, the cost of computers went down by 75% because the power went up and the price went down, and so we're gonna reduce inflation by that amount, which is crazy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these are all the tricks that, I mean, it's like every couple of years they add some new trick to the way that they calculate unemployment and inflation, to the point that these numbers are now absolutely meaningless. And we need to have meaningful numbers, because you're right, people living on Social Security should be able to at least live on Social Security. Mike, thank you very much. You said it very well. John in Hollywood, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. There's one comment you made earlier that I'd like to, talk about. You mentioned that what we're seeing in this trickle-down bailout is the nationalization of some of these private corporations, but I think it got it backwards.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing is the privatization of our nation, because throughout our history, whether it's a corporate administration like you mentioned, or a less corporate administration like FDR, there's always been that move to make it privatized and make it more like, well, you know, the riddle, what's a total privatized nation? It's a monarchy.
Right.
There's always been that movement to go to consolidation of power.
Right.
And
that's what we need to be pushing back against, John. And this is where I think that your point is well taken. And this is where I think we can actually reach across the aisle and even say to conservatives, you know, if you really believe the principles you're talking about, we need to be pushing back against that kind of power. Craig in San Jose. Quick point, Craig. We got about a minute.
Yes. Just wondering if we assume that what we were doing before Reaganomics was you know, a much better way to go, then I'm wondering, how do I explain, and maybe the previous caller, answered this, but how do we explain how badly the economy was doing in the late 70s?
Well, in the late 70s, 25% of the workforce was unionized. So more than 50% of the workforce had the kind of pay and the kind of benefits where one person could raise a family, buy a house, buy a car. It looked bad at the time because we were comparing it to how it had been in the 60s. but compare it to now, where the private, you know, workforce that's unionized is around 7%, and the number of people who are, I mean, in the 1970s, you had, I don't remember the statistics right off the top of my head, but the number of latchkey kids, in other words, kids coming home to an empty home, was far lower than the 50% that
it
is right now.
So it would have been better to just stick with what we were doing?
Yeah, I'm saying at the very least. I mean, let's go back and just, we had some protections against some of the insane actions that are happening right now. I think we can invent it better, frankly. I think we could do a whole lot better. But let's start out by just undoing the damage that's been done by the conservatives since then. Coming up tomorrow, Republican strategist Barbara Comstock of the Workforce Fairness Institute. We're going to talk about the Employee Free Choice Act, plus Robert Kuttner, co-founder and editor of American Prospects. He's got a new book about Obama. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.